मनोबुद्ध्यहङ्कारचिन्तानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मे चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं 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 मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचिन्तानि नाहि न च श्रोत्र जिह्वे न च घ्राण नेत्रे न च व्योम भूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानंद रूप शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूप शिवोहं शिवोहं न च प्राण संज्ञो न वै पंचवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पंचकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानंद रूप शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूप शिवोहं शिवोहं न मे द्वेष रागौ लोभ मोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्य भाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानंद रूप शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूप शिवोहं शिवोहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखं न मंत्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानंद रूप शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूप शिवोहं शिवोहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकार रूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासंगतं नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानंद रूप शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं 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 मनोबुद्ध्यहङ्कारचिन्तानि नाहम् न च श्रोथ जिह्वे न च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योम भूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातून वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ न मे लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखं न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासं नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, and everything in between. I'm so happy to be back with you and to just feel the presence of all of you here in this etheric space we share. I've been loving what people have been sharing on the listserv this week. Alice wrote in that she thinks that everyone's gone into Laya Bhavana, that our awareness has merged into the Sahasrara, because the listserv has been pretty quiet this week. But many of the notes that I've been reading are about the way the practice is operating in your day-to-day life. In other words, the way this course, this text, the meditations that we're doing inside the awareness that the text offers us is actually creating a kind of natural transformation. And to me, this is very much of a piece with my experience of the Shiva Sutras, the Recognition Sutras, the Vijnana Bhairava, the other texts of the Kashmir Shaiva, the Tantric, non-dual Kashmir Shaiva, Trika tradition, that the text itself is a guru. And I mean that quite literally and quite seriously. You know, one of the things that happens when you're in the presence of an enlightened teacher is that part of what gets kindled is a kind of witness awareness that starts showing you yourself. And one of the ways it shows you yourself is, of course, by showing you the things that are in the way of your experience of the self. But more than that, it starts to open you up to a kind of witness awareness that is poised in, you know, what we call, for want of a better word, an enlightened state. And it's a state of consciousness in which what is reflected back to us is our highest potential. And even if we have some problems adjusting our minds to that, what we will experience is how our highest potential begins to be enacted in our daily experience, our day-to-day life. So the blessing that the text gives will actually touch every part of your life, and some of them very unexpected, obviously depending on your personal karma, your needs, where you're at this moment. But one of the reasons that we keep coming back to this text is to get back in touch with that source of grace. And what I've noticed in myself is that this is not about scholarly understanding. Study is not about scholarly understanding, although some of us are geeks in one way or another, and we're interested in understanding the text with our intellect and really looking into the Sanskrit, reading different interpretations, etc. But essentially, for most of us, and certainly for me, studying texts like this is basically a spiritual practice. it's about the shift in consciousness that occurs when I'm reading it, studying it, etc. So we don't have to become scholars to work with these teachings, but what we do have to do is be willing to turn them over, to hold them in the mind, because that's where the alchemy is. So without some attempt to study the text, and I mean the Shiva Sutras, this can also be true of a different text in the same tradition, but without grappling with the text itself, with the words of the sutras, it's much more difficult to land the fundamental teachings of the non-dual tradition. For example, the basic teachings of Shaivism are really simple. Consciousness is everything is basically the teaching. It's pretty much the gist of it here, as it is in most of the non-dual traditions, certainly in India. But, you know, if you're anything like me, when you read a teaching like the Self is Consciousness, Chaitanyam Atma, because you've heard it so much, I mean, most of you here have read a lot of spiritual books. Many of you have gone to a lot of workshops, studied with different teachers, and you've heard this teaching. So in a certain way, it's something you already know. You know, you've heard it quoted in a Deepak Chopra talk or in yoga class, and it's part of your mental furniture. It's like a filter that you can put on when you remember, that you can sort of look at your life through. But there's a difference between, you know, kind of holding a teaching like this as a kind of received belief or dogma, you know, as they say, and actually turning it over, doing manana, as the Sanskrit says, you know, just like holding it in your mind and contemplating it and letting it shed its alchemical gifts over you. And it's like what happens when we do that. And for me, and I think for many of you, actual studying the text, thinking about the text, and practicing in the context of the text acts like a kind of magnet, which, as long as you're keeping it more or less uppermost in your mind or dipping into it every day, is going to act like a magnet that draws the most enlightened particles of your consciousness to you and brings them alive. So that, you know, and you know how we all have, you know, about 14 different versions of ourselves, depending on which samskaras are up at the moment. You know, so that I recently spent time with a young friend of mine who's really one of the most, she's one of the more spiritually advanced people I know, and she's having boyfriend problems. So in the weekend I spent with her, pretty much all she was willing to talk about was her boyfriend issue and her various opinions about it and, you know, and what she was going to do about it. Because when she's in that space of being a young woman, you know, trying to understand the patterns in her relationship, the overall picture, the big picture, the fact that they're both aspects of Shiva are pretty much irrelevant because she's fully in her individual self. So one of the things that I get from this text, and that in fact she gets because she's also a student of Kashmir Shaivism, is, you know, that sort of shift that makes you go, oh yeah, I have all these problems, but, and at some level I have no problems, because whatever is going on is basically going on in Shiva. And there's something about the radical authority that with which these sutras are given, you know, that makes you really get that you're in the presence of a source of truth that, even when you don't understand it, even when it's not your immediate experience, you somehow know that it ultimately can't be argued with, because the reason you don't get it It's because your level of consciousness hasn't risen to meet it, and that the text itself will raise your level of consciousness. So for me, as a modern, you know, a modern educated, so to speak, rational person who wasn't brought up in a religious tradition and who has a kind of natural suspicion of religious traditions, it was very profound for me to meet this tradition, which is in many ways quite religious. You know, I mean, the being at the heart of the teaching is conceived of as a personal form of God. But there's something about the experience that you have when you read it that makes all questions like, is this a religious thing? Is this a Hindu thing? You know, how does this fit with quantum physics, which it kind of does? Because you're having the experience over and over again of really plunging into the heart of the mystery and feeling the power and the beauty of the mystery. And I have to say, this might sound a little shocking, but when we choose a philosophy of reality, probably one of the deepest reasons we choose it outside of culture and family issues has to do with how it makes us feel. And there's a certain point in your life when you begin to turn back and look at the effect of certain words, certain understandings on your inner state, and to realize that it is actually okay to choose a view of reality that uplifts your consciousness. You know, in other words, to say, okay, a lot of things that go on in this world might make me believe that for the existentialist form of nihilism could be true, but how does this make me feel? It makes me feel hopeless. It makes me feel like not getting out of bed in the morning. But when you're looking at reality as an expansion of the divine intention to experience bliss by manifesting itself as diverse consciousnesses, then life is not just an adventure, but it's an adventure that unfolds within a feeling of what I can only call the absolute okayness of everything. One of my friends was teaching a class on Shaivism once, many years ago, when someone raised his hand and basically said, do you really believe all this? So I think he asked the question in a more formal way. But my friend said, without hesitation, he said, doesn't matter whether I believe it or not. Whenever I accept it as true, I am instantly uplifted. And uplifted not in a way that, you know, keeps you clinging and dependent on a particular deity or on being part of a religious community, but uplifted because it puts you in touch with that part of yourself that is untouched by the ups and downs of your life. Even for a second, this is going to make a difference. You know, I've been experiencing in the last few weeks, because I'm a sort of a political news junkie, and it's very hard for me not to read the news. So that means that in the kind of state of upheaval that the politics in the United States is in now, and in fact the global situation all over the world, is often disturbing and scary for many, many reasons, including, you know, the epistemological crisis that we are in since, at least in this country, people really aren't sure that what they're reading or hearing is true. But what I find that if reading the news and thinking about global politics and climate change feels like being trapped in a hot, dark room filled with uncertainty and somehow paralyzed in this view that things are really bad, jumping into the Shiva Sutras is like walking outside and looking at a big sky, or like jumping into a beautiful, cool lake. It's enormously potent for shifting your perspective out of the actual hot darkness that arises in us when we believe that things are as they seem, into a kind of expanded perspective that can expand into, you know, what the texts call Shiva Drishti, the outlook of Shiva, which is always, oh, okay, everything is rising and subsiding inside consciousness, and no matter how it seems, the inner impulse of it is love. So we're going to spend a few minutes doing our own preliminary ritual, chanting our mantras, doing our first meditation. So I want to ask you to start with what I consider kind of basic pratyahara, which is to first find your physical posture. I'll give you more exact instructions in a minute. And begin to breathe with the feeling that on the exhalation, you're letting go of everything that's been going on in your day. So you inhale very easily and naturally. And as you exhale, you imagine that what happened in the morning, what happened at the office, what happened in your conversation with the plumber, whatever it is that your mind has been dwelling on today, it just flows out with the exhalation. And as you do that, imagine yourself taking your seat in the space at the end of the exhalation. So as the breath flows out, as the exhaled breath dissolves, maybe if only for 30 seconds, hold your awareness there. Not so much that you get out of breath or that, you know, fear comes up, but just enough so that you can taste the stillness, the relative stillness, when the breath has completely been let out. And as you keep bringing your awareness into the space at the end of the exhalation, what you're doing is bringing yourself into what the sages of Trika Yoga tell us is the fundamental posture with which a yogi of this tradition begins her practice or begins his practice. The posture is the posture of stationing yourself in the space at the beginning and end of the breath. Because in that space, we open ourselves to the possibility of falling through the rabbit hole out of ordinary consciousness into that state which is called the madhya, or the center, where in the space between one activity and another, we can touch for a moment the still source whose power, whose shakti is making the breath happen, is making thoughts happen, is making perception happen. So let yourself settle in the space at the end of the exhalation and realize that by doing that, you're taking your seat in the truth. So with that as your basic posture, let's now do the external posture. And if you, hopefully you have your chanting sheet. You begin by allowing the inhalation to ground your body through the sit bones and to let the exhalation arise from the depths of your lower body and gently draw your spinal column upward through the crown, allowing the breath to flow down with the inhalation towards the base, and maybe pause for a fraction of a second to feel the still point. And then let the exhalation draw the spinal column upward through the crown. And see if you can let the breath pause here for a moment. And your shoulder blades melt onto the back. Your face is soft. Perhaps you can feel yourself centering over the bony triangle formed by the pubic bone in front and the two sits bones behind, so that your head is poised over the center of that triangle. And we'll take that as our basic posture, even though, of course, your body will move and shift in the course of our time together. And we'll begin by chanting the Ganesha mantras, invoking that being of huge elephant body with his crooked trunk who shines like billions of suns, asking that he remove all obstacles from our practice, from our transmission and our reception of these truths. And then we'll chant the Maha Mrityunjaya mantra three times, and the invocation of Shiva as the Guru who removes the disease of worldliness, of worldly confusion, and finally to the primordial goddess, the auspicious one. So with a deep breath in and an extended exhalation, imagine for a moment that you're seated in the presence of the round-bellied, elephant-faced god Ganesha, who is playful, roly-poly, filled with sweetness. And we'll chant. Vakratunda Mahakaya Koti Surya Samaprabha Nirvignam Kurume Deva Sarva Karyeshu Sarvada. And we'll close with Om Ganganapataye Namaha five times. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. One more time, Om Ganganapataye Namaha, feeling as we say these mantras that the spirit of Lord Ganesha, who is one of the deities of the Muladhara, so he's a deity of groundedness, feel that he's in your body, that your body is completely firm and stable with the awareness of Ganesha. And then we'll chant the Maha Mrityunjaya Mantra. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. And two more times. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. And the Dakshinamurti Shloka, which praises Shiva in the form of the Guru. And in this practice, if you're so inclined. You might imagine that the famous yogi form of Shiva is seated over your head, and that as you chant, you are making a subtle request that his transmission of truth come into your body through the crown and begin to infuse your mind and heart. And we'll chant, invoking the grace of the primordial teacher. Gurave sarvalokanam bishaje bhavaroginam nidhaye sarvavidyanam dakshina murtaye namaha. I bow to the guru of all worlds, to the physician who cures all worldly ills, to the ocean of all wisdom, to Dakshinamurti Shiva, the Lord who initiates us into the highest truth. And now to Shakti, she who is the source of everything and also the giver of liberation. And one thing I like to say about this invocation to the goddess is to remind you that the goddess comes in many, many forms. So she's youthful and beautiful. She's also old and wizened. She's everything in between. She has billions of body shapes, one of which is yours. And in every one of these embodied forms of goddess, and when I say embodied forms of goddess, I mean male forms as well as female forms. In every one of these forms, her essence is completely grace-giving. Sarva mangala mangalye Shive sarvatra sadike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. So you can refresh your posture. And we'll take just a moment to bring ourselves into the sense of connection with the community. Remembering that this community is it's a collection of each other's, it's an amalgamation of each other's highest selves. You know, what we bring here, what we bring to this gathering is not our small self, even though, of course, our small self is touched by it, but it's really our most loving, enlightened, most divine self. And as we invoke these aspects of ourselves and each other, we don't just connect to the circle, we connect to the heart of the universe, which lives in every one of us in utter purity, utter freedom, and who is deeply in love with us. So as the breath flows in, begin to feel that it slides in through your crown as a stream of sparkling blue radiance, like a river of light that is flowing from a region high above your crown, a region that is mysteriously hidden from view, but which radiates this blue light of absolute vitalizing Shakti into your crown, flowing from the heart of the universe, from the Mahadevi, from the great goddess, from Shiva. And as this light flows in from above, you feel it bathing your brain. You feel it flowing into the heart. And you sense the light filling the heart. And as you inhale and exhale, drawing blue radiance down from the crown into the heart, you see it forming a lake of pure awareness that vibrates with depth and radiance which is the true expression of your heart. You're summoning the blue radiance of consciousness, the great lake, that not only represents the heart of the universe, but which is your own true heart. Now you bring your attention, you allow your attention to flow to the base of the spine, to the perineum, just in front of the coccyx. And this time, inhale with the feeling that the breath flows in all the way down through the crown, all the way down to the base of the body. And that with the exhalation, a deep scarlet-colored light rises up from below the body, from the heart of the earth, in through your perineum, and flows into the blue lake in the heart. And I've taken a long time to describe that process, but it's a natural happening as you inhale, the blue radiance flows down to the heart, and you feel it forming the lake. And then you feel that radiance flowing down to the base of the body, and then the exhalation flows up as scarlet light and merges in the heart. So as your awareness follows this pattern, receiving the blue radiance from above into the heart, and feeling with the exhalation that the scarlet light rises from the depths of the earth through your body into the heart. And gradually your attention settles in the lake of the heart. And you find yourself aware that this lake that is in your heart is in all of our hearts, and that in fact it's one vast lake. Each of us in our individual bodies are seated around the rim of the lake, which is the source and center of all life. And feel that your fingers light a flame that is resting on the lake. So as we all sit together, gazing into the lake of consciousness, which is both outside and inside, feeling the presence of all of these lights, let yourself relax into the presence of these flames floating on the great lake of consciousness, of which you are both the witness and the embodiment. So see if you can allow yourself to emerge from meditation without actually emerging from meditation. In the deep teaching of Trika, the understanding is that the creation and maintenance and dissolution of the universe happens through our own process of perception, which at its core is not the perception mediated by your senses or your mind, but is actually the creative perception of Shiva Shakti. So the deep truth about this moment is that when you return to what we call waking consciousness, you're bringing this visible world into existence once again. And of course, the more deeply you've been able to touch your essence, your true consciousness, the more possible it becomes to kind of grok that it's that consciousness which is bringing your reality into existence. And again, just getting that for a fraction of a minute, a fraction of a second, is transformative. So this is going to be kind of a yoga geek class in which we'll explore some of the characteristic yoga practices of the Anava Upaya aspect of the Shiva Sutras. And we started doing this last week, of course, when we looked at the Laya Bhavana practices that are described in Sutra 4. And it was also, these were also included in the homework, which I hope you all had a chance to look at. And if not, maybe you'll look at it this week, because hopefully this class will make that sutra even clearer. So just a moment of academic geekery. You know, I want to remind you that for us who are reading the sutras in the form that was handed down to us from the 10th century sage Kshemaraja, who was the main commentator on the Shiva Sutras, the Spandakarikas, or Stanzas on Vibration, the Vijnana Bhairava, and quite a few other texts. You know, his name is Rajanaka, Kshemaraja. Rajanaka is an honorific that was given to sages in that tradition. And you'll remember that Kshemaraja was a close disciple of the great tantric guru Abhinavagupta, who basically defined non-dual Shaivism as we know it today. His book Tantra Loka is the great, let's call it, human authority on this set of teachings. And basically the way we understand it today is based on his approach. So the remarkable thing about both of these masters is that they were adept in several lineage teachings, the Trika lineage, which the Shiva Sutras is the source text of, and a now very hidden lineage, a very obscure lineage called Krama, and another obscure lineage called Kaula. But I particularly want to mention the Krama lineage because it's kind of a hidden aspect of all of Kshemaraja's commentaries. He was very much a goddess worshiper. And the form of goddess that the Krama lineage sages worshipped was Kali. She's worshipped under different names, different forms. But they are really the tradition that truly explored how the flow of human perception is actually the flow of the Shakti of consciousness from the source. And in the Krama Sutras, the basic understanding is that the world is constantly being created, sustained, and dissolved through your senses. And those of you who studied the recognition sutras, the Pratyabhijna Hridayam, with me or another teacher, will remember that at the heart of that text is a practice which equates your perception with Shiva's fivefold act. And this understanding is, I would say, the kind of crucial seat that we hold as Shaiva Tantrikas. If you remember, or if you don't remember, the moment when we perceive an object, when we look at an object, is the moment of creation. It's analogous to the divine act of manifesting a universe. As we keep our attention on the object, we're enacting Shiva's act of maintenance. When we look away from that object towards another object, we're dissolving the first object. So this process of creating, sustaining, and dissolving the world is constantly going on. And the thing is that when you turn away from the first object towards another object, in our human experience, that first object does not disappear. It is actually concealed inside our consciousness in the form of a seed, which we would call a samskara, a hidden impression. And it remains there, concealed inside consciousness, ready to sprout at another moment. But we always have the choice to give ourselves grace to enact the fifth divine activity of Shiva Shakti by reminding ourselves that our true nature is consciousness, and by offering these concealed samskaras into the fire of consciousness by simply bringing them into the central channel with the breath and allowing them to rise up through the crown, where they are offered to the subtle awareness, the subtle consciousness beyond the body. And this process, these processes, which are the basis of Trika Yoga, are done in all sorts of ways. So what I would say is that this basic teaching that Goddess, the primordial creative power and her inner essence, which we call Shiva, the stillness of the source, are acting through our human perception, and that there is no difference between your perception and the flow of creativity from the highest consciousness. So all their intellectual effort, all Kshemaraja effort, all his scholarship was in the service of landing this radical idea. My perceptions are Shiva's perceptions, and the goddess is appearing as the world I experience, including the world of my body and thoughts and emotions. So Shiva Sutra, these two teachers were utter, absolute, hardcore, take-no-prisoners non-dualists, brilliant realizers who devoted their lives to recognizing every single particle of reality as a microcosm that contains the fullness of Shiva Shakti. So when the Shiva Sutras teaches yoga, when it teaches the methodologies of yoga, it always starts in non-duality. And that's why we do these practices of Laya Bhavana, because in Trika Yoga, when you do a preliminary practice, when you settle yourself to meditate or to study or to remember who you are, you always begin by dissolving your individuality or your sense of individuality into the highest truth. So you always start by remembering that you're the Absolute. And the thing is that one of the things I love about Trika Yoga and the higher tantras in general is that they're incredibly generous about yoga practices. I mean, they're willing to do any form of practice as long as and only if it leads to recognition of your oneness with the truth, your oneness with Shiva. And it, in this respect, in this regard, the teachings of Trika are actually based, or they use the map of the eight-limbed Ashtanga Yoga that's described in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. But they do it by redefining yoga so that it's non-dualistic. And the great question that Trika asks us if we're going to do a practice is it possible to actually experience full samavesha, full immersion in the Supreme Chidananda through this practice? In a certain sense, everything in Trika is understood to be potentially a direct doorway into pure awareness, but only if we do it with a non-dual understanding. So we're going to do this practice. We're going to do this particular practice of Laya Bhavana, which is also known as Bhuta Shuddhi, with a non-dual awareness, and we're going to do it several times this evening. And as we do, my hope is, or my intention is, that it'll become more and more settled for you. It'll become more and more natural for you. And then as we kind of cook our bodies in this preliminary practice, this preliminary Bhuta Shuddhi practice, which is one of the heart yoga practices of Anava Upaya Yoga, of Trika Yoga, what we understand is that it becomes both, using the map of the Yoga Sutras, it's both a practice for pratyahara, for withdrawing your attention from the external into the internal, and a practice of dhyana, of meditation. This is, you know, we've been working with these practices this week, especially with the version of it, the Kaladni Rudraya practice, where we set the body on fire. And I hope that you've enjoyed doing that, by the way. It's actually particularly helpful if you're in the part of the U.S. that's being blanketed by snow. So this one of the practical applications of the Kaladni Rudra practice is that it does create heat in your body. And as you may know, tantrikas in the Indian tradition and in the Tibetan tradition will tend to work a lot with elemental practices for practical results, for health and and other personal gifts that we can get from doing these practices. Some of you might be aware of the very famous Tibetan practice of cultivating inner heat in the belly center, the second chakra, where you imagine a fiery orange ball getting hotter and hotter, and then you bring it up the body and spread it through the body. And if you're familiar with this tradition, you know that the way yogis were tested is that they would be immersed in an icy river, and then with all their clothes on, and then they would demonstrate how quickly they could dry their wet clothes with the heat they'd cultivated in their bodies. And so these element practices, as we're going to see later on tonight, can be used in a very practical way, and they're also the basis of the famous yoga siddhis, which are very much an aspect of Tantra. So let's do our first Bhuta Shuddhi practice. Bhuta Shuddhi means purification of the elements. And it's often done as a preliminary purification process aimed at removing the schmutz from your chakras, because as we know, the chakras, the internal energy systems, accumulate a lot of stuff in the course of life. And it's customary when you begin practicing yoga to start by doing a kind of bathing practice, which if you're doing the external yoga, and I recommend this before you sit for meditation, it's really good to take a shower or wash your feet, because this is actually a practice for removing one layer of the various glitches and schmutzes that we accrue in the course of a day. And it's also very important to remember that in Trika Yoga, even though a Trika Yogi would definitely take a bath before meditation under normal circumstances, there's also the understanding that the true agent of purification is the Kundalini Shakti, which as it rises through the body and spreads through the nadis, will naturally and spontaneously purify us of all of those samskaras and vasanas and latent diseases, etc., that we've accumulated, not only in this lifetime, but also in other lifetimes. So in the Buddhashuddhi practice that's done as the preliminary yogic meditation, the idea is not to purify the elements in a physical or psychological way, although that definitely happens when we do this practice. It's to train our consciousness to merge the grosser elements into the subtler elements, what the texts call the different constituents of your embodied self, into its source, and thus ascending to subtler and subtler levels of your self-identification. And the extraordinary thing about this process is that it's supposed to not only roll up your individual experience of mistaken identity, but it's also supposed to dissolve the physical universe's mistaken idea about itself. Why is this? Because the universe is actually inside your consciousness. So when you draw your consciousness up through the elements, which are the basis of our personal experience of a universe as something separate from us, when you draw your consciousness up through these elements to subtler and subtler levels, what you are also doing is withdrawing the universe back into your own consciousness. Obviously, you just do this for yourself. You know, the universe still remains for me. But it really is a very real phenomenon that as you practice this over the course of time becomes more and more an actual experience and not just something that you're imagining or making up, because it really does kindle your capacity to completely interiorize your experience. Before I talk more about this, I think we should meditate. And the way we're going to do it is not by working with the chakras, We're going to do it by working with these rather esoteric points in the body that are associated in the early tantric texts with the elements themselves. So, again, these points were included in your homework, so maybe some of you have practiced this during the week. I hope so, because every time we do a practice like this, it becomes more familiar to us, and that means the next time it's going to be easier. These are practices that, as I wrote in the homework document that we sent out, these are practices that you actually can use in daily life to kind of enhance your experience of the elements. But what they're really about is literally raising your consciousness, uplifting your consciousness. So this practice comes from the Swachanda Bhairava Tantra. That is one of the source texts that Kshema Raja used in exploring and explaining the Shiva Sutras. And I just want to say that the promises that are made about this practice are true. They're not exaggerated, but you do have to enter them. You have to work with them and eventually find the internal source of each one of these meditations. So we're going to do a meditation on the points of the body that correspond to the elemental deity powers. We'll go from earth to water to fire to air to ether, which is the standard way that we rise through the elements, breathing in and out of each of the points and using the elemental mantra of each one. And we'll do it with a recording of the bija mantras for the chakras. Lam for earth, Wam for water, Ram for fire, Yam for air, and Hum for ether. But let's find the touch points. So the elemental touch points here, as I said earlier, are not the chakras, but they're actually places, points located in the physical body that you find on the outside of your body. What I've found with this meditation is that it really is about transforming your experience of your physical body. And, you know, if you remember from the homework, the earth point is located at the base of the throat. You know, if you put your finger in that little U-shaped notch at the throat and kind of poke, you'll feel this point. That's the earth point. The water point is in that little hanging flap of skin that, you know, that's suspended from the top of the soft palate that moves when we speak and when we breathe, and you obviously can't touch it, but you can find it if you bring your awareness to the top of the soft palate. This is the point of water, fluidity. The fire point obviously is at the navel, just as the third chakra point is at the navel. Air is in the center of the chest, in the place similar, the same place where we find the heart chakra in the more conventional Bhutashuddhi meditation. Ether is above the crown. It's the space that we enter when our attention rises from the top of the head and begins to dissolve into the space above the crown. So we're going to go through these practices in sequence, and I'm going to guide you through them, and at a certain point I will direct you to listen to the sound, to allow the vibration of the sound to actually be felt inside this point in the body. And when we do that, Deb will play a very beautiful recording of the chakra, of the elemental mantras being chanted. So just start by refocusing yourself, finding your comfortable seated posture. It's good to be upright, but you don't have to be as completely upright as you would be if you were doing the chakra practice along the Sushumna. And this is really important. Make an intention that you're going to fully immerse yourself in the practice. So begin by bringing your attention and the breath into the base of the throat with the intention to feel into the subtle essence of solidity, groundedness, physical strength, as it's expressed in your bones, your flesh, the fleshiness of your organs. And as you listen to the sound of lum being chanted, allow the sound to be felt in this spot, right at the base of the throat, lum, as you inhale and exhale through this point with lum. Hear the vibrational resonance. Lum. Sit with this awareness, breathing into this space and either silently repeating or hearing the resonance of the chant vibrating at the base of the throat. And let your attention now rise to this subtle place at the back of the soft palate, near the larynx, the seat of fluidity of water in the body. And just begin now to inhale and exhale into this point. At least in my experience, once you decide that you're going to focus there, it begins to reveal itself. So it's really towards the back of your throat, in the back of the soft palate. And the breath naturally flows there because it is part of the nasal cavity. So as you inhale and exhale into that point, focus on the fluids in the body, your blood and saliva, your lymphatic, menstrual, sexual fluids, all of which are part of the element of water. And as you listen to the Bija mantra of water, Vam, as you let that resonance vibrate in the back of your throat.
Vam.
And as you continue focusing in this spot, just let the resonance of Vam vibrate there. Again, inhaling and exhaling with the sense that the breath touches and opens the water element and its seat. Now bring your awareness to the navel. And inhale and exhale as though you were breathing in and out of the navel, feeling the inhalation touching the navel center. So this is the seat of fire, which is connected to your bile, your digestive fluids, and also to the neural connections that interlace themselves through your whole body and transmit information, which is fire, through every cell and nerve ending of your body. So focusing on the navel, allow the resonance of Ram, the Bija mantra of fire, to resonate in the navel.
Ram.
The breath is continuing to flow through the navel. And you silently or out loud chant to yourself, Ram, feeling the resonance. And let your attention come into the center of the chest and sense the power of the prana shakti, the air element in your body, which is manifesting as the different pranas, the vital airs that carry energy through the nadis, through the channels, that power your movements. You know, it's the air element that gives your joints the power to move, that allows your eyelids to blink. And the air element, of course, also manifests as all the different gases that flow in your body. Some of them helpful and some of them not so helpful. So with our awareness of the air element in the heart, and as we breathe into the heart, allowing the resonance of the sound yam to penetrate through the layers of density around this region, just let yourself feel that all of the pranas, all of the gaseous flows in the body are being vitalized and divinized by the mantra. So let yourself resonate with the sound yam. As you sit breathing in and out of the heart, sense the resonance of yang vibrating and resonating there. Now let your attention rise to the space just above the crown. And as you inhale, allow the inhalation to flow in from above and the exhalation to flow right up through the crown. This is the seat of the space element, the etheric element. And of course, it's also the place where our denser elements dissolve. The mantra of space, of ether is hum. And essentially what we're doing as we vibrate the mantra and breathe into this space is we're kindling a sense of becoming comfortable with the dissolution of the denser elements into the subtlest of all the physical elements, which will eventually lead us into the place of the purified awareness. So with your awareness, your attention, just above the crown, inhale into that spot, and with the exhalation, allow your attention to rise as you sense the resonance of hum in this place above the crown.
Hum.
Let hum vibrate with the breath. You'll probably notice how the energy tends to gather here in the crown. And part of what the energy wants to do now is dissolve into the space above the crown, into the space that is characterized by the sound Om, which is really the space where consciousness begins to rise through the different layers of your subtle essential self to eventually recognize the presence of Shiva Shakti above you, above your body, but also a natural part of your extended body. And of course, the resonance, the sound of this space is Om, which is both the sound of manifestation and the sound of liberation as consciousness rises. Let your attention once again linger in the space above the crown. Let it rise as high as it can naturally go as you listen to the resonance of Om being chanted. And again, let yourself feel the resonance. You can chant Om or just feel the residue of the chanting. And we're going to actually take our consciousness through all these points much more quickly. So allowing what we've been kindling in this preliminary practice with it to start to take root. So let your awareness come into the base of the throat. And as you breathe in and out of the base of the throat, have the thought, lum, lum, lum. And draw your awareness up to the spot at the back of the throat and the back of the soft palate, the fluidity point with vum. The energy flows through the navel now as the breath flows into the navel and out through the navel with aram. And flows up above the crown with hum. And then the breath rises as you allow yourself to silently or out loud flow with the thought, Om. And once again, awareness in the pit of the throat, Lum. Awareness in the back of the throat, Wang. Awareness in the navel, Ram. Awareness above the crown, Hum. Awareness rising, Om. And let yourself for just a moment or two stay in the resonance of the rising current of Om. Now, with your attention, in that space above the crown, see if you can bring your awareness to awareness itself. To becoming conscious of that knowing, intelligent presence that is holding all your experience. And just remind yourself, this consciousness, this awareness, which is present as the knower in every moment of my life, is the microcosmic form of the great source of this universe. So just let yourself inhale and exhale with the inner query, the inner intention to take note of your state in this moment. And if you're feeling very out there, very merged in awareness, you might also want to hold the intention to bring your attention down the body into the heart. And though I'd love to hear how this practice is landing for you, I don't want to force you to say something if you don't feel like it. But I am inviting you to ask a question if there's something about the practice that you're not sure about, or report an experience. And if you want to do that, you can press star 2. To raise your hand.
We've got somebody that raised their hand in California.
Okay. Do you want to tell us your name?
This is Lakshmi, actually, in Washington, D.C.
Hi, Lakshmi.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. So I'm still a little out there from this practice. It felt really dynamic, and I could feel a lot of resonance in my body. But I actually have a question. On Sunday, I was doing the Kala Agni practice.
Uh-huh.
I actually did a kind of intense practice day on Sunday. It just kind of happened. I had a big fight with my boyfriend, the only kind of spiritually connected relationship I've had, and we had a big fight last week, and I was just kind of hibernating and doing a lot of practice and contemplation in the morning, and I took a nap, and then I was doing the Kala Agni practice, which felt really powerful, actually, and really cleansing and really spacious. And a couple hours later, I went out to run an errand, and I got a call from my neighbor that my garage was on fire.
Oh, my God. How did it, what happened?
Which, somebody,
I mean, did you put it out?
Yeah, it got put out. I mean, somebody backed a stolen car into the garage and set it on fire, probably to get rid of some evidence. But I had only been out of the garage like 20, 30 minutes. I mean, everything is okay.
Right.
I mean, other than there was a lot of trauma. And then as I was waiting, as soon as I pulled up to the site, a fire truck backed into my car and damaged my car. So,
good heavens.
I went, okay, Kali, but, you know, aside from that, this is not the first time I've had this, like, sequence of Kali kind of things happen. But I got a little bit unsettled because, you know, I've done a lot of fire practice with you over the years, but the Kala Agni was intense, and I just wanted to ask about
how the,
you know,
outside,
the
inside
world
resonates with the outside. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm going to give you the yogic answer to that issue.
Okay.
And, you know, I do think that when we're strong practitioners and we have a lot of Shakti moving in our body, there can be experiences of the outside mirroring the inside in many different ways. But if you're doing a fire practice and you have a tendency to have the fire expand, then what you do at the end is bring in water. You know,
okay,
we're talking about the elements here, right?
Yeah.
So imagine your body being, you know, this fire that you've kindled in your inner body being soothed and dissolved in cleansing nectarian liquid. Bring it in through your crown. Really, really let it fill your brain and body all the way down to your feet.
Okay. It, you know, the practice, after I ended the practice, it felt, you know, it felt purifying. It felt cleansing in a very beautiful, loving way.
Yes, I totally get it. And I don't necessarily believe that the inner experience and the fire in your garage are connected.
Okay.
Though, you know, it's an interesting coincidence. But nonetheless, if you find yourself starting fires, the antidote is water. You know, it's
okay.
And yeah, I mean, you're in Washington, D.C., which seems to be psychically on fire at the moment. So
yeah.
It doesn't surprise me. Yeah. So that's completely interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
but
I'm trying to hold this as like, okay, well, what's the purification, bigger purification of my life? You know, maybe there's something supposed to arise out of this that I have yet to discover. I don't know, but...
Yeah, well, yeah. And, you know, when the Shakti starts to move through your life in dramatic ways, I'm gonna remind you that a lot of the ways these things play out at a particular moment have to do with cycles, you know, cycles in your that are expressed in your astrological chart, cycles that are part of, you know, energetic conditions that are flowing in your neighborhood, in your environs. So it may not even have anything to do with your practice. But clearly that was a day, an intense day. You'd had a fight with your boyfriend. You know, there was a lot of emotional energy. And it makes sense to me that it might, you know, given your capacity to externalize inner states, which is, you know, a yogini quality that you have, it makes sense. But I would say the way to think about it is as a natural dissolution that is essentially burning karmas. Because I believe that's what is happening when something like that occurs. You know, it's like the external event is a kind of it's an intense kind of short-term experience of a karma being lifted or a karma being burned. And, you know, generally speaking, you know, once you've let some time pass, you start to realize that the karma that is manifesting could very easily have been a much bigger karma, like your apartment catching on fire or, you know, something much more destructive. So, and I think it's really important when you're doing tantric practice to realize that what's happening, even if it seems difficult, is actually part of the process of bodhisattva. It's purifying the karmic elements in your life. And,
yeah,
you know,
it was a sign. It was like, it's working.
It's working, exactly. But you know, but don't, I mean, I know that, this is why I suggested that you just do a water practice and soothe it, even if the practice feels really good.
Yeah, that was my question. Like, should I not do a Kala Agni practice? Do you have suggestions for the practice and for what I should do in general, or more the bodhisattva with all the elements? Or
I would suggest that you work with this practice that we just did, and you know, because what's really happening in Kala Agni, in the Kala Agni Rudraya practice is that what we're actually doing is dissolving consciousness into space, right? Because as the fire dissolves our physical body, it's also dissolving, it's also, you know, raising our awareness. So the result is the same. It's, you know, there are various bodhisattva practices, one of which, of course, is the classic chakra practice, you know, raising the chakras, the mantras through the chakras. But the purpose of it is to dissolve your sense of being limited by your physical, subtle, and causal bodies into that space, which will carry it eventually into, you know, the source. So all of these practices are for the same, they have the same result. And I'm giving you a couple of choices, which the Shiva Sutras does also, essentially so that you can find the one that feels copacetic to you. You know, the idea being to purify your the limitations caused by the elements, to purify the attachment to the elements that keeps you bound, so that you become more and more accustomed to allowing all this to dissolve, to, you know, letting consciousness rise. And of course, at the end, it's a really good idea to bring it back into your body, you know, because you are going to live in the body. But don't worry about these effects. And I want to talk about something which I see there was another hand raised, and I'm going to give you a chance to ask your question. Lakshmi, I thank you so much for bringing that into our conversation. But there is a set of teachings that connects to what you're experiencing. So if the next person who wants to ask a question or share an experience would like to do that now, we'll, and I'm happy to hear it and speak to it if necessary, and then we'll go on and talk about the siddhis that this practice gives you. One of which is the capacity to set your garage on fire. So
we didn't have someone raise their hand, but I got a couple of questions from over on the webcast. And Bari asked, as you first went through the elements, you included the heart. As you went quicker through them, you excluded the heart. Then you suggested we moved into the heart to come back. She's just curious about
did
the
I,
order.
If I excluded the heart, it was an accident. I didn't intend to.
Okay.
So no, that has no bearing on the practice. It goes base of the throat, pit of the throat, the area up in the soft palate, the navel, the heart, the area above the crown, and then the rising element. It's always the same order. But what you could do, this is not in the Shiva Sutras, but it's an interesting way to end this practice. You can actually follow this pathway back into embodiment. So you can bring Om and your attention back down to the area just above the crown. Let Hum and your attention flow back into the heart. Let Yum and your attention flow into the navel. Let Ram and your attention flow into the area of the soft palate, and then let it all resolve with Lum in the pit of the throat. And this kind of rekindles the elements. It sort of puts everything back where it was in the first place. So rather than completely rising and dissolving, you rise and dissolve, and then you kind of re-embody, which is a very genuinely tantric approach to practice. So thank you for that question. I'm sorry I skipped the heart on the second go-round. So we'll take one more question.
Radhya asks, could you please spell the seed mantra for the uvula or water point? Do we need to even let go of this expanded state as we continue with anava upapaya?
Well, that's a really good question. Lum is spelled V-A-M, though it's sometimes spelled V-A-N-G because the M is a nasal sound. It's an anusvara. So it's not a hard M or a hard ng. It's a long, you know, and we'll discuss bija mantras a little bit later. Many of you are aware of the importance of the resonance of the ng sound at the end of the mantra, because that's what actually vibrates the centers. It's what vibrates the points. But what was the second part of the question?
Do we need to even let go of this expanded state
No.
as we continue?
No.
Okay.
No, we don't. I mean, the point of Anavapaya practice is to just let that dissolve happen and stay there as long as you want to and as long as you're comfortable. I would say from my own experience, and I think many of you would echo this, that when you get up from meditation, you want to put your awareness back in the body, mainly so you can function without stumbling. As we practice, and you're going to see this in our later classes, or the Shiva Sutras in any case describe this in the later classes, how you maintain that expanded consciousness in open-eyed practice. It's a very important aspect of the Shaiva Tantra. So first we teach ourselves to get there, and then we teach ourselves how we can intelligently keep our consciousness expanded. So if any of you who've gone into deep meditation on the upper Sahasra, please feel free to stay there. You don't have to come back, at least not until you have to get up and go about your evening or your day. But I want to say something that's a really significant point of this tradition, and it's also very significant that it's discussed right at the beginning of the third book of the Shiva Sutras. And this has to do with the teaching in Sutra 6, which is the Sanskrit is Moha Varana Siddhihi. And what that means, Moha means Maya or illusion. Siddhi means accomplishment or superpower. And Varana means covering. What this sutra is saying, that this elemental practice that we just did is one of the official tantric practices for acquiring siddhis or supernormal powers. And it's one of the, to me, one of the most interesting aspects of the tantras, as it is also the Yoga Sutras, that they include siddhis, they describe them, they actually give you methods for cultivating them, and they also make the point, which Shiva does right here in this point, that the reason that siddhis are acquired in the course of doing this practice is because, you know, it happens to people who are still in Maya, who are still attached to the stages of individuality that are covered by Maya. So we naturally tend to get very interested in the individual powers that come about through yogic practice. And the thing that the sutra tells us, and we're going to get into it much more intensely next week, is that if you get, you know, and those of you who studied yoga know this because it's pretty much, you know, a feature of all the yogic texts, that if you get allured by the various powers that begin to arise in you as a result of doing these elemental practices, you kind of get stuck. And the idea is that when your intention is to rise beyond Maya or to really become identified with your highest consciousness, then the powers, the abilities that will naturally arise when you do a Buddha Shuddhi, when you do these particular elemental practices, the powers will arise and you'll be able to exercise them without getting attached to them and without taking them that seriously. So, and this is, again, it's one of the really significant aspects of tantric practice, is that the tantrikas do work with siddhis, and they, you know, they recognize siddhi as a significant yogic attainment. It's just that they want your experience of them to be held within the recognition that these are properties of limited consciousness and that there's much more beyond them. So I want to just talk about the connection of the elements, you know, the Buddhas, earth, air, fire, water, and space, how and why they're connected to the mastery of the physical universe. Because remember, these elements are, in their subtle essence, the elements are internal. So the whole practice of tantric non-dual tantra is that the elements arise within you, meaning within Shiva, and as very subtle sensory experience, inner sound, inner light, inner touch. They're called in Sanskrit, as many of you remember, the tanmatras, the subtle elements, and they are prior to the physical elements. They're as consciousness descends through the process of perception, your first experience of embodiment is of these inner sensory experiences, which will then, you know, usually, I mean, the transformation of the subtle elements into the experience of the physical world as something outside of you happens so rapidly in our normal experience that we're not really able to follow the process. But when you actually go inside in meditation and you start to experience the inner world, you experience the inner world as these subtle elemental sensory experiences like visions, lights, inner sounds, the feeling of blissful touch, which is one of my favorite subtle experiences, you know, etc. So we start to realize the tanmatras, to recognize the tanmatras in meditation and, of course, in dreams, because it's these inner elements which make up the dream world and the whole visionary experience of the dream world. So the mastery of the elements, which starts with the mastery of the tanmatras through meditation, is the basis for transforming physical reality, which is why I find that so interesting that Lakshmi's fire meditation was succeeded by an actual fire in the physical world. It's this capacity for using the subtle elements, you know, for cultivating the subtle elements in meditation and having your inner cultivation be mirrored in external experience is the basis of elemental magic in all traditions. It's what witches do. It's what magicians do. It's a feature of occult practice, really all over the world, including, of course, European witchcraft. I happen to tune into a Netflix show called A Discovery of Witches, which is, you know, a rom-com about a witch and a vampire who fall in love. It's actually pretty fun. But it's full of moments where the heroine, who's a witch, is able to make rain, sort of a rainstorm happen because she's internally grieving or surround herself with fire in order to ward off enemies. In other words, she has the elemental magic. That's an example of the capacity that certain tantric adepts have to transform the outer world through inner experience. And the fact that this is possible and that it can be cultivated is of course kind of dicey, because these powers can be misused, they can be weaponized, as in black magic, which is a feature of the tantric world in India and Tibet, as it is in Western occultism. And it's one of the reasons why tantra is, you know, kind of looked on as a potentially dangerous practice, not because it is for people like us, but because there are people who cultivate elemental magic through tantric element practices, which include harnessing elemental spirits for different purposes. This is one of the reasons why the sages warn practitioners not to get too fascinated with siddhis. My guru tells a story about a time when he got kind of interested in a particular mantra that gave him some superpowers. And he went to see his guru while he was working with this, and his guru yelled at him, "Don't use these siddhis, that's, you know, just a distraction." But it's also true that as these powers start to open up in you, they are indications of the strength of your practice. So there's this paradox. You know, you're not supposed to cultivate them, and I'm going to give you some of the reasons why. But also, they're going to appear. They're going to happen. And I think, you know, when people write in about the ways in which your life has been transformed through practice and study, especially tantric practice and study, but in fact, many, many types of yoga practice, these transformations are actually the appearance of siddhis, of the yogic attainment, which when we're doing strong inner cultivation is also going to kind of begin by showing up in your day-to-day life, sometimes in ways that actually dissolve situations that are not helpful to your sadhana, and sometimes by giving you, you know, abilities like healing and other capacities, which for many of you manifest automatically, and there are the famous siddhis, you know, which include things like invisibility powers and the ability to teleport a cake from Chicago to Delhi, as Yogananda Paramahamsa describes in Autobiography of a Yogi. You know, there's lots of stuff that yogis learn to do, none of which are particularly helpful in self-realization, but, you know, which in India are one of the ways that sadhus make money is by demonstrating these siddhis. But what I find more relevant to, you know, people like us is that there are certain abilities, including healing, including being able to attract people to you, to draw people to you, you know, kind of what we call charisma in this culture, and the ability to manipulate people's minds, often in ways that we may not be conscious of, but sometimes we are conscious of them. And, you know, when you hear those stories about gurus who manipulate their students, what they're showing is the way yoga siddhis arise in strong practitioners and how they can be used in ways that may be beneficial at a certain level to the people around you or to yourself, but which ultimately don't help anybody and certainly will impede your progress on the path. You know, I would say for many of us who are yogis, especially teachers, most of us have had a lot of lives of having these, you know, particular skill sets appear as a result of our yoga practice. And probably in many cases we've gotten into using them, you know, becoming healers or psychics, becoming, you know, gurus who offer something that feels powerful until, you know, the person who's experiencing the teacher's power starts to feel used, manipulated, or disappointed. I mean, we all know how these things happen. But, you know, for instance, in the film Wild Wild Country, which I think many of you have seen, you know, which is about the very famous 20th century guru Rajneesh, also known as Osho, who was, of course, a tremendously talented teacher and spiritual intellectual and had a lot of transmittive powers. And if you see that film, you see how his yogic skills, his siddhis, you know, inspired students and empowered students to do all kinds of extraordinary things, including building, you know, a kind of amazing community in the desert in Oregon, and also led them to you know, get powerfully deluded in a way that brought the community down. So I kind of believe that none of these people intend to misuse their siddhis. It's just that people who have these gifts have a very hard time not using them and not identifying with them. And of course, you know, we tend to be fascinated by people who demonstrate skills like this, you know, by healers and psychics and people who seem to be able to read our minds. But what is particularly interesting in the Anava Upaya section of the Shiva Sutras, which we're going to talk about in another class, is that there are different levels of siddhi, some of which are distractions and some of which are kind of dangerous, but which are also considered a built-in, baked-in part of the yogic path. So the closer you are to states of liberation, if you're a tantric yogi, the more siddhis, the more superpowers you tend to have. And so, of course, you know, you have entire traditions, like the Christian tradition, based on a group of disciples' incredible devotion to a teacher who demonstrated his enlightened state by healing people. And then you have yogis like Sai Baba of Shirdi or my guru's guru, Nityananda, who had so many yogic powers at their fingertips that you could just walk into the room and, you know, ask them for a blessing in a very mundane area of life or for protection. And they could say yes, and it would happen, you know, because these powers, these yogic superpowers would just pour out of them. And the source of these powers is mastery of the elements, you know, the Buddha Shuddhi practices, which give you a deepening measure of control over these elements. This is an interesting topic that the tantras are quite courageous about describing and bringing into awareness, because in the tantric path, we're always walking that paradoxical razor's edge between experiencing the innate power that we embody as individual Shivas and the tendency of egoically based consciousness, you know, the consciousness that's under the control of Maya, to arrogate these powers for our individual self and to try to use them for purposes that may not even be harmful or intended to be harmful, but which are always going to keep you under the control of Maya. Because the whole, you know, this practice of the practice of Laya, of letting the density dissolve into the subtle and having as your goal the experience of your fullness of Shivaness, is actually has to be kept in the forefront of your consciousness if liberation is what you're after. So that's part of what we come to realize as we do these practices, is we come to be able to tell the difference between the part of ourselves that is, you know, that is looking for what, and I want to say this without critique, because it's the natural way that we think when we're in a mayic state, when we're living through the prism of, you know, the mind, the individual intellect and the ego, that there is a discernible difference between the experience of enacting the gifts that we have as individuals from an egoic point of view and allowing them to flow through us naturally without attaching to them. And this particular kind of discernment is one of the questions that I want to give you for your homework this week, not in order to make you feel uptight about the gifts that yoga has given you. You know, not at all. The gifts that yoga has given you they're important and they're signs of progress on the path. But the question is, how do you know when, you know, you find yourself being a healing presence in someone's life, or, you know, or the effects of your yoga begin to manifest as, you know, having people want to be around you? How do you hold this? How do you make it a blessing for yourself and others? And how do you keep it taking you higher into merging in your own consciousness, rather than getting so attached to it that, you know, that you're starting to identify yourself as a yogini or a yogi with superpowers, which, as many of you know, as many of us know, generally ends up in some kind of humbling experience, and, you know, which it, at some time in our life, we just have to say, I'm in this for liberation. I'm very grateful for the gifts that yoga gives me and the ways in which my yoga practice enhances my day-to-day life. You know, the tantras are not, they're not, it's not a renunciant tradition, so it's not telling you that there's anything wrong with living a life enhanced by the gifts that yoga gives you. But what it does ask you is to discover what discernment looks like as you progress on the path. Because as you progress on the path, you'll become more and more expanded, and you'll experience more and more of your natural divine gifts. And these will affect other people, they'll affect your life, and they're beautiful. But the question is, where do they come from, and who is it that is really acting when you experience the powers of Shiva Shakti moving through your individual body mind? So with that question, let's just take a moment to center ourselves in the space at the end of the exhalation. Just allowing yourself to naturally inhale and exhale. And then as the exhaled breath merges in the air, to linger for a fraction of a moment in that still point, until the breath comes in. You don't want to hold the breath for longer than a second or two. Let the breath come in and flow out. And let yourself be for a few seconds in the still point, which is the source of the breath, the source of your life, and which, as many of you know, can expand in meditation into a full opening into consciousness, into Shakti, as your source and your essence. So have a beautiful evening and a beautiful week. The audio of this class will come tomorrow, and your homework will come tomorrow. Have a fabulous Thanksgiving if you're someone who celebrates Thanksgiving, and a fabulous day after tomorrow if you're going about your normal life in Germany or Greece or Ceylon. And much, much love to all of you from me as we touch the love that is the heart of the universe. Namaste.
मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचेतानि नाहि न च श्रोत्रजिह्वे न च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानंद रूप शिवोहम शिवोहम चिदानंद रूप शिवोहम शिवोहम न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानंद रूप शिवोहम शिवोहम चिदानंद रूप शिवोहम शिवोहम न मे द्वेष रागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहम शिवोहम चिदानंद रूप शिवोहम शिवोहम न पुण्यम न पापम न सौख्यम न दुःखम न मंत्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहम् भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहम् चिदानंद रूप शिवोहम शिवोहम अहम् निर्विकल्पो निराकार रूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासंगतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मेय चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहम शिवोहम चिदानन्दरूप शिवोहम शिवोहम चिदानन्दरूप शिवोहम शिवोहम चिदानन्दरूप शिवोहम 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 शिवोहम